This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. This week, the music of the Beatles became available for the first time on iTunes. And there's another new release as well, a book of photographs that includes many rare shots of the Beatles in their early days. It's by Astrid Kircher, the German photographer who, in 1960, was the girlfriend of Stu Sutcliffe. He was the bass player for a group that was playing clubs in Hamburg, Germany, a group called the Beatles. Here they are in a 1961 recording with John Lennon singing lead on Ain't She Sweet. Astrid Kircher took many pictures of the young musicians then and continued to photograph them after Stu Sutcliffe left the group. In 1961, he died suddenly of a brain hemorrhage. Astrid Kircher was on the set of A Hard Day's Night in 1964, but stopped taking pictures of the Beatles and other subjects in 1967. After that, she assisted other photographers instead. A current exhibition of her work is on view in Liverpool at the Victoria Gallery and Museum. And an exhibition catalog, Astrid Kircher, A Retrospective, has just come out in paperback. Terry Gross spoke with Astrid Kircher in 2008.
Astrid Kircher, welcome to Fresh Air. What led you to go hear the Beatles in the first place when they were performing in Hamburg where you lived?
Well, the first time I met the Beatles was to my former boyfriend, Klaus Voormann, who saw them one night when he was wandering around Hamburg. And then he heard this beautiful sound of rock and roll music, and he went down into a quite dark, filthy cellar where these boys were standing on a very, very tiny stage and performed in such a way that he was absolutely, let's call it, knocked out by the music and by their looks and everything around it. So he told me about it, and it took him a couple of days to convince me to go with him to see the boys, because the Reeper Barn is not a place where young ladies in the 50s or 60s were to have seen or go there. You know, it was not a nice place to go. But one night I just said, all right, I come with you. And so we went there. And when I went down the stairs and looked at the stage, I was just amazed how beautiful these boys looked. And being a photographer then, it was a photographer's dream. Ever that first night, I went nearly every night to see them. And that's how it started.
Now, you describe when you first met the Beatles that their hair was greased back.
Yeah.
How did you change their hair, and why did you change it?
Well, my boyfriend Klaus had a big problem because his ears used to stick out. And then I had the idea to just grow the hair over them, which he then did, and it looked absolutely beautiful. So when the boys saw Klaus, Stuart was the first one who said, oh, I would like to have that hairstyle. And because their hair was very long, I could do it in one night, so which I did. And Stuart was the first one who performed on stage with the so-called Beatles or Klaus haircut.
Yeah, I never heard it before referred to as the Klaus haircut.
Yeah.
So how did the other Beatles decide to pick up on the same style?
When they finished playing in Hamburg, they went back to Liverpool, and I visited Stuart there. And then George came up to me and said, could you please cut my hair like Stewart's? But the other two didn't want to know about it, John and Paul. And Pete couldn't have the hairstyle anyway because he had curly hair. But a little bit later, John and Paul went to visit an old friend of ours, another German photographer called Jürgen Vollmer, and he persuaded them to have their hairstyle changed. And so they came back from Paris looking like the rest of the Beatles.
What other changes did you make or suggest to the Beatles about their look or their clothes, whatever?
Well, the fact is that Stewart was the same height as I am, and he could wear my clothes. So immediately when he moved in with me and my mother, he got hold of all my clothes, like leather pants, leather jackets, collarless jackets, and white shirts with big, big collars like in the old days, and waistcoats and big scarves and things like that. But when he first appeared to play with them in Hamburg again, he used to wear a suit of mine made out of corduroy in black, and it had no color. It was colorless. And John just couldn't stop laughing and said, oh, have you got your mom's jacket on? So that was the start of the colorless jacket, which later on it was copied all over the place. But in fact, I copied it from Pierre Cardin, and a Paris designer who I saw in a magazine or something, and I thought that was a fantastic idea.
Well, if John was making fun of Stu's jacket that didn't have lapels, how come he ended up wearing one himself? Like, what changed the attitude from mockery to I want one too?
Well, John was always a little bit of sarcastic, so at first, even with the hairstyle, he couldn't stop laughing. But in the end, he just joined in. That was John. That was typical.
It's interesting that Stu Sutcliffe would wear your clothes, because most men wouldn't dream back then, particularly, of wearing their girlfriend's clothes. It would be more okay for a girlfriend to wear her boyfriend's clothes, but not vice versa.
Well, you know, Stuart was a very special person, and he was miles ahead of everybody, you know, as far as intelligent and artistic feelings are concerned. He was miles ahead. So I learned a lot from him, and because in the 60s we had a very strange attitude towards being young, towards sex, towards everything, because it was still so short after the war, and we had this big burden to carry as far as our parents and as far as our country after the war.
Well, tell us a little bit about what it was like to be a teenager growing up in post-World War Germany.
Well, it was very hard, because it is hard to imagine now that there weren't any magazines. You couldn't buy any English authors or anything that came from America, like jeans or whatever. It was impossible. So we had to do our own clothes if we had weird ideas, like wearing long scarves like the French people did. You had to knit them yourself, or long sweaters you used to nick from your father, because they were miles too big, because you wanted to look like the Sartre people in France or in Paris, like Juliet Greco or other people. And I was very, very much influenced by the films of Jean Cocteau and by Sartre and everything that came out of France, because it was closer than America or England. And anyway, England was then told by the older generation of Germans, we're still our enemies.
Did that come between you and the Beatles at all, the sense that your countries had recently been enemies? Did that Did that interfere at all in the relationship?
No, not in our relationship. Mm-hmm. But John used to make funny remarks of it from stage, because most of the youngsters couldn't speak English because we didn't have English in school. At, you know, in the beginning, when after the war we went to school. So he used to shout from states, "We won the wall, and you Krauts," and all that, you know, which most of the people didn't understand. But the English people, they just were furious with laughter.
So that's why he said it, because he knew the German people wouldn't understand.
Yeah, sure.
It's been a hard
Terry asked Astrid Kircher about her early connection to the Beatles.
You became engaged to Stu Sutcliffe, who at the time when you met him in 1960 was the bass player in the band. You seemed so taken by all of the Beatles. What special happened between you and Stu Sutcliffe? What was the bond that you had?
Well, it's very strange, and maybe it sounds sort of sentimental, but when I saw him for the first time, I knew that was my man. You know, he was and still is the love of my life, even though he's gone for such a long time. But I never ever, and I was married a couple of times, met another man who was so fascinating, so beautiful, and so soft and well-mannered, you name it, and that he was. And so, such a gifted artist.
It seems to me you both lived in a very visual world. I mean, he was an artist who learned to play bass so he could be in the Beatles. And you, of course, you know, were a photographer, a very visual person. So even though you didn't speak each other's languages at first, he's English or German, it seems like you must have had this visual connection.
Yes, there was a sort of bond between us, because maybe I correct you there. Stuart just played in the band because John persuaded him to be in the band. And the first painting Stuart sold, John persuaded him again to buy a bass for that, to be in his group. So actually all Stuart wanted was to become a good painter.
Why did John want him in the band? Why did John want him in the band so much, knowing that he didn't know how to play?
Well, because John always said, when Paul was moaning about, you know, how Stuart didn't practice and all that, but John always said, it doesn't matter, he looks good. He is rock and roll.
So you were engaged. What kind of life had you envisioned for yourselves together?
Well, when you're young, you just in love, and every day is so new and so fresh and so beautiful, you just don't think of the future. But Stuart was there very mature, and he thought he could become a teacher in art school in London. And so that was what he was planning, and then that'd be maybe go back to England, or he gets maybe he could teach in Germany.
He died, Stu Sutcliffe died of a brain hemorrhage after a series of excruciating headaches. When he was getting those headaches, did you think and did he think that they were a symptom of something very serious?
No, not at all. Because, I mean, when you're so young, you don't or death doesn't occur to you at all. It is not, it's so far away. I mean, a 21-year-old boy, you never think that there's something very drastically happening to him.
You know, you said that death doesn't occur to you when you're young, but you had to deal with it. You must have been quite shocked.
Of course I was, but you know, all my friends helped me an awful lot, and first of all John did, you know, and George, the two of them.
How did they help you?
Well, John, you know, John had a very funny way of telling the people he loved what was going on. And one day he just said, you have got to decide if you want to live or die. There is no other question. And you think about that, and then we talk about it again. And George was just sweet, you know, not like John in a harsh way, but the things that helped me was John.
So you made the decision to go on.
Yes.
And continued with your work as a photographer?
Yes, yes.
What were you photographing when the Beatles went back to England and they were no longer your muse?
Well, you know, I was an assistant to a very famous German photographer, and he had a big studio where we did advertising pictures and portraits of famous musicians and things like that. You know, a real normal photo studio. So I worked there, and next to it, my boss I could take pictures and develop them in his darkroom, which was absolutely great. So I just wandered around and took pictures of my friends and things like that. But the work was very, very hard, and so I didn't have the time to take a lot of pictures.
The photos in your new book, Yesterday, The Beatles Once Upon a Time, are from 1964 when they were shooting A Hard Day's Night. How did you end up with them when they were shooting that?
Well, the magazine Stern in Hamburg, maybe you know the magazine, the chief photographer there was a friend of mine. And so he knew that I was very close to the Beatles, and he asked me if I could sort of act as a door opener for him to take pictures of the Beatles. And because at that time, when they did A Hard Day's Night, Brian Epstein stopped all the press activities, and no photos were allowed to be shot then. So I phoned George, and, you know, George was always my sort of guardian angel, and told him about it. And he said, okay, you can come over if they pay you for it. Otherwise, you can stay at home. So I went to the Stern and told them, and they gave me quite, for the 60s, quite a good amount of money. And then we went over, and George sent a chauffeur, and they picked us up from the airport. And I stayed with George and Ringo then, at the time they were making the film. So, and then when we went to the movie and did all the shots of them acting and relaxing and having fun, after that we went to Liverpool to meet Ringo's father and mommy and Georgie's mom and dad.
Are you still taking photographs?
No.
Why not?
No, because, you know, when all these Beatles thing was going on, nobody was interested in my other work. No one at all. They just said, yeah, great, great. Where are the Beatles pictures? And so I wasn't sure if I'm really good, or is it just the Beatles that made me sort of, in a way, famous? And I wasn't sure anymore if I'm good or not. So I just gave it up. That's it.
What did you do instead?
Well, I was always an assistant to a photographer for another 20 or 30 years. And then I started interior design, and I just did things which I liked to do, you know, which had at least fun.
Just one last question. I'm kind of curious. How do you dress now? What's your look now?
Still in black, and I've got very short hair. Uh-huh. Still like to wear leather pants. Even I'm going to be 70 next year. And, I try my best to look okay, you know.
Still into long scarves?
Yeah, a little bit. But that is because they're fashionable again. I wouldn't wear them if they weren't fashionable.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was lovely talking to you. Thank you very much.
Astrid Kirchherr speaking to Terry Gross in 2008. Her collection of photographs, Astrid Kirchherr, A Retrospective, is now out in paperback. The exhibition on which it is based at the Victoria Gallery and Museum in Liverpool continues through January. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine were songwriting partners during the golden age of Broadway and MGM musicals. They're best known for writing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, a song Judy Garland sang in the movie Meet Me in St. Louis.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Once again as in olden days, happy golden days of until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
Hugh Martin has written a new memoir recounting his songwriting years called Hugh Martin, The Boy Next Door. Terry spoke with both Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine in 1989 about the movie version of Meet Me in St. Louis, which was directed by Vincent Minnelli. Terry asked them about working with Minnelli.
Did he have any suggestions about how he wanted to get into the songs? And
oh, boy. He sure did.
He's a very
brilliant suggestions.
Can you give an example?
The best example, I think, is that when we wrote the trolley song and everyone had loved it, Vincent came up with the idea that he wanted it sung by the chorus before Judy sang it, which sounded terrible to me. I couldn't understand why he wanted that. It just seemed wrong to me. But now seeing the movie, I can see how beautifully that idea worked out of having the chorus kids come in on the car and set up the whole melody and lyric idea.
And then John Truett, the boy next door, dashing and trying to catch the trolley, and she's so thrilled that he's trying to make it and does finally at the end.
He masterminded all of that, and he was wonderful, wonderful director.
Did his telling you how he wanted to stage it affect how you wrote the song at all?
Oh, yes, because when he wanted that extra chorus of a trolley song, we had to write a brand new lyric for it.
See, it's on the way to the fair,
mm-hmm.
and we made it a travelogue of where what part of St. Louis we were driving through.
But we welcome that sort of being produced by brilliant people like Minnelli and Freed. It brings out the best in us. We don't resent it. We love it.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, I want to play a version of the trolley song. Now, this is a song that's kind of owned by Judy Garland, in a way,
yeah.
as a singer. But on this version, we're going to hear Hugh Martin singing it. And this
How
is
nice.
From an album that Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine made together in 1957.
I'm very flattered. Thank you.
Let's give it a listen.
Okay.
With her high starched collar and her high topped shoes and her hair piled high up on her head, she went to find a jolly hour on the trolley and found my heart instead. With my light brown derby and my bright green tie, I was quite the lonesomest of men. I started to yen, so I counted to ten, then I counted to ten again. Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings. For the moment I saw her, I fell. Chug, chug, chug went the motor. Bop, bop, bop went the brake. Thump, thump, thump went my heartstrings. When she smiled, I could feel the car shake.
Martin, I like your singing a lot.
Oh, bless you, Terry.
Do you still sing?
You know, just your playing the record has given me the old itch to sing again. I'm going to go home and do my vocalises. Thank you for playing it.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with the clang clang lyric?
Well, after we had written three different songs for Arthur Freed, which we thought would be corny to be about a trolley. I mean, we thought that we'll write something wonderful for Judy to sing on the trolley. And we did three different songs, which she said, I know, oh, I love it, it's a beautiful song, but I've got a better place for it, I'm going to use it in the Follies.
Which he never did. It was a tactful way of throwing them out, and I'm so glad he did.
And finally he says, now about the trolley song, I want you to try again for me. And I said, Hugh, he's not going to take anything less than a trolley about, a song about the trolley. So I went to the public library in Beverly Hills and was rummaging through some old turn-of-the-century newspapers and found a picture of a double-decker trolley, which they incidentally used in the movie. And under the trolley picture said, clang, clang, here comes the trolley. And I said, Hugh, look at this. And Hugh said, clang, 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 went the trolley. And about was very few minutes, he had the whole thing going. In fact, it didn't take long to write that song at all once we got the first line.
It was exactly 3 hours. Can you believe it?
We were in Freed's office demonstrating it in 3 hours.
Yeah.
And he said,
so
no, that's what I wanted all the time.
We're so excited.
He knew what he wanted.
That's great.
And you know, oh, this is interesting about the verse. Remember, Ralph, I called up Irene Sheriff, who had done the costumes for the film, and I said, Irene, could you tell me what Judy might be wearing in this scene? And she said, why do you want to know? And I said, well, we're working on this new song for the trolley, and I might be able to work in some of those phrases if I know what they wore in those days. And she said, well, it might be, she might have on a high-starched collar, she might have on high-topped shoes. And I said, might her hair be piled high up on her head? And she said, yes, it might. And well, I said, might the boy be wearing? And she, you know, I practically set her words to music from
right.
the costume description.
And then when the picture was made, her hair was hanging down, not piled
yeah.
up on her head.
That's right.
He
That's
was wearing
right.
a straw hat, not a brown derby.
They screwed us up again.
Didn't do a thing that the lyric said. We're but doing it in the show.
But it made a nice verse.
Yes.
But of course you don't think about that as you're
right.
listening and watching.
Right.
Have you both been in retirement for the last few years?
No.
Ralph always says no, and I always say yes. So you explain your standpoint.
Well, you're never retired as long as your head is on your head and you think of things you can put down on paper. It's not like physical. I mean, it's mental.
I always say yes because I haven't done anything in show business for like 15 years. Well, I've been very active in church work. That's the passion of my life now. Is that I became a Christian 10 years ago and got baptized, and now I'm a zealot for Jesus, and that is more exciting to me than the theater.
Do you do music within the church?
Yes, I've written a few sacred songs, but they're not as good as my pop songs, so I've sort of stopped doing it, but I do play a lot. I use my 10 fingers to, I go on camp meeting circuits and all those things. I tell Ralph I feel just like Katharine Hepburn in the opening scene of The African Queen when she's pumping away at that old organ and her hair's flying.
Well, I want to play you, Ralph Blaine, singing something from the Martin and Blaine album, again recorded in 1957. And why don't we listen to you singing The Boy Next Door, one of the songs that you both wrote for Mimi in St. Louis.
Good. He does that beautifully.
Do you want to say anything about writing the song before we hear it?
Boy Next Door? It was just one of those melodies that really I'm so grateful for, because it really just came out of the blue, and then we put lyrics to it. There's nothing really special. Oh, there's one little special thing about it. After it was more or less finished, I asked Ralph if he thought it needed any finishing touches, and he said, why don't you work the address into it, Sally's address, 5135 Kensington Avenue. So we added that, and I think it's a nice touch.
That's a wonderful touch. I love that verse.
That was her real address.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to skip the verse and start with the melody, because we're so limited for time.
I really messed you up. That's okay.
I live at 5135 Kensington Avenue, and he lives at 5133.
Hit it.
How can I ignore the girl next door? Doesn't try to please me, doesn't even tease me, and she never sees me glance her way. And though I'm heart sore, the girl next door affection for me won't display. So I can't ignore her, the girl next door.
That's Ralph Blaine singing "The Girl Next," the boy next door sung as "The Girl Next Door."
I have a terrible habit now. I've been listening for 6 weeks now as the young lady Donna Kane sings The Boy Next Door, and I tried to sing it on an interview the other day, and I completely got mixed up, and I had the boy and the girl all mixed up. My sexes were completely, totally destroying me. It was, I couldn't help myself.
Now, you once told the story on our show about how you and your late partner, Ralph Blaine, wrote Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Can I ask you to tell it again?
Well, first of all, I feel rather self-serving admitting this, but Ralph didn't really write it, honey. We wrote our song separately, so it's words and music by me.
Oh, well, good. So now you're really able to tell the complete story.
I can really tell the complete story. Ralph was working in one room, and I was working in another on Meet Me in St. Louis. And I played the first 16 bars of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas over and over and over and got stuck. I couldn't find a bridge for it. And so I just put it aside and decided not to work on it. And Ralph, who had heard it through the walls, came to me the next day and said, whatever happened to that little madrigal-sounding melody that you were playing? And I said, well, I couldn't make it work, Ralph, and so I discarded it. And he said, well, you find it and finish it, because I have a big feeling about it. And so we did find it, and I did finish it. But the original version was so lugubrious that Judy Garland refused to sing it. She said, if I sing that to little Margaret O'Brien, they'll think I'm a monster. So I was young then and kind of arrogant, and I said, well, I'm sorry you don't like it, Judy, but that's the way it is, and I don't really want to write a new lyric. But Tom Drake, who played the boy next door, took me aside and said, Hugh, you've got to finish it. It's really a great song, potentially, and I think you'll be sorry if you don't do it. So I went home and wrote the version that's in the movie.
Now, I should explain that in the 1944 movie musical Meet Me in St. Louis, when Judy Garland sings this, you know, she and her younger sister are very, it's Christmas time, but she and her younger sister are very unhappy because their father's job is taking him from St. Louis to New York. And he's going to move the whole family to New York, and they don't want to go and leave their friends behind. So the younger sister, played by Margaret O'Brien, is crying, and Judy Garland tries to comfort her by singing the song. Now, you said that the first version was lugubrious. What made the lyrics lugubrious?
Well, I'll sing it for you. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last. Next year we may all be living in the past. Pretty sad.
But you changed that lyric, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. The one in the movie was, have yourself a merry little Christmas. Oh, until then we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. That was one that was in the movie. Then I got a phone call from Frank Sinatra saying, I'm doing an album called A Jolly Christmas, and I love your song, but it's just not very jolly. Do you think you could jolly it up a little bit for me? So then I wrote the line about, have you hang a shining star upon the highest bough. And Frank liked that and recorded it. And people, they do, sometimes they do that line, and sometimes they do the muddle through some line somehow.
I like the muddle through one.
I like the muddle through one better, too.
We're about to hear a version of Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas that you recorded a year ago.
That's
and
right.
Was released earlier this year in a CD that's called Hugh Sings Martin.
Right.
And this features recordings that you've made, you know, throughout your career, particularly like in the 40s and 50s.
That's right.
But it has this new recording from a year ago. You made this recording when you were 90?
I was 90 years old. I don't know how I got through it.
and you're at the piano playing and singing. It's quite beautiful. Do you want to say anything about making this recording before we hear it?
Well, I just want to say, Terry, that I never would have continued singing at all if it hadn't been for you. Because you did an interview with Ralph and me in 1989, I think it was, when Meet Me in St. Louis opened on Broadway. And you played a little recording of me singing the trolley song. And I was just about to stop singing because I wasn't getting all that much encouragement. But when, at the end of the cut, you said, ooh, I like your singing. I like it a lot. And that thrilled me so that I kept on singing.
Well, it thrills me to hear you say that, and I still really like your singing.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for writing such a great Christmas song. Some of those Christmas songs tend to wear thin.
Well, God really
your
blessed
song
me.
Is so enduring. It's just one of the most beautiful and moving, I think, of all the Christmas songs. So thank you so much, and thank you for talking with us again.
Thank you deeply for saying that. Big golden days of yore, faithful friends who were dear to us, gather near to us once more.
Hugh Martin playing the piano and singing. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2006. His new memoir, called Hugh Martin, The Boy Next Door, has just been published. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1. This is Fresh Air. The blockbuster series of films based on J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels continues with Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1. It's based on the first half of Rowling's seventh and final Harry Potter book. The three young heroes are no longer at Hogwarts School for Wizards, and the dark wizard Voldemort is eliminating his enemies. And, of course, Harry is at the top of the list. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
There's nothing wrong with the 2.5-hour Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 that couldn't be solved if this weren't, in fact, Part 1. If the saga ended here, instead of stopping at the climax and saying, in effect, see you in 2011, suckers. But 2 years ago, Warner Brothers got antsy about losing its so-called tent poles, multi-part properties that prop up the studio, and decided to split J.K. Rowling's seventh and last book into two films. I'm surprised they didn't split the second part in two, and the second part of that in two, and on into infinity. The movie has no satisfying finish, but to be fair, it has no satisfying beginning either. Wander in without having seen another Potter film, and you won't have the faintest idea what's going on. I needed a refresher course in Horcruxes. The Harry Potter wiki site says they're objects, quote, in which a dark wizard or witch has hidden a fragment of his or her soul for the purpose of attaining immortality. You need to know that, since the whole movie is the dark wizard Voldemort's nasty hordes chasing Harry and his friends Hermione and Ron as they try to find and destroy various Horcruxes. The first hour of Deadly Hallows is virtually a video game, and it's deadly all right. Voldemort's followers have taken over Hogwarts School and the Ministry of Magic and are on the hunt for Harry. Director David Yates does a poor job on the opening action sequence, in which Harry's friends and allies transform themselves into Harry lookalikes to confuse the onrushing villains. It's a funny scene when they all get Harry-fied. But Yates stays with the real Harry during the aerial chase, missing the obvious sight gag of bad guys thrown into confusion by so many bespectacled young men of small stature. Then Harry and friends sneak into the ministry to steal one of several Horcruxes, and the sequence is so badly staged and goes on for so long, the filmmakers appear to be filling out the running time. The surprise is how much better the second part of Part 1 is, when the action stops dead. Harry, Hermione, and Ron go on the lam and drift around the English countryside, across barren landscapes under low gray skies, getting on one another's nerves. In an invisible tent they've erected, Rupert Grint's Ron finally breaks and attacks Daniel Radcliffe's Harry and Emma Watson's Hermione.
What's wrong?
Wrong? Nothing's wrong. Not according to you, anyway.
Look, if you've got something to say, don't be shy. Spit it out.
All right, I'll spit it out. But don't expect me to be grateful just because now there's another damn thing we've got to find.
I thought you knew what you signed up for.
Yeah, I thought I did too.
Well, I'm sorry, but I don't quite understand. What part of this isn't living up to your expectations? But did you think we were going to be staying in a 5-star hotel, finding a Horcrux every other day? You thought you'd be back with your mum by Christmas?
I just thought, after all this time, we would have actually achieved something. I thought you knew what you were doing. I thought Dumbledore would have told you something worthwhile. I thought you had a plan.
I told you everything Dumbledore told me. And in case you haven't noticed, we have found a Horcrux already.
Yeah, and we're about as close to getting rid of it as we are to finding the rest of them, aren't we?
Ron, please take the Horcrux. You wouldn't be saying any of this if you hadn't been wearing it all day.
Do you know why I listen to that radio every night, dear? To make sure I don't hear Ginny's name. Or Fred. Or George. Or Mum.
What, you think I'm not listening too? You think I don't know how this feels?
No, you don't know how it feels! Your parents are dead! You have no family!
Stop!
Finally, go! Go then!
That's excellent psychodrama, and it's a vivid reminder that with all the enchanted kingdom imagery of Rowling's first books, her real subject is deadly serious. In common with her fellow Brits, Tolkien and Orwell, Rowling is haunted by harbingers of fascism, in this case, race-based fascism. Voldemort's allies are purebloods, obsessed with rooting out muggles and mongrel mudbloods. The film's feel is paranoid, post-apocalyptic, and it's no wonder the central trio's well of affectionate banter has run dry. The rest of the actors are practically extras. It's like a Royal Shakespeare Company Halloween party. Helena Bonham Carter shakes her fright wig. Brendan Gleeson models his eye patch. Alan Rickman has a line or two. Michael Gambon, John Hurt. On one level, it's a waste. On another, hail to Warners for subsidizing their low-paying stage work. The series is a British actor tentpole, too. Rafe Fiennes' Voldemort provides the scares. He looks like a flesh reptile and declaims like Captain Hook if the crocodile had bitten off his nose instead of his hand. I sure hope he gets a good send-off in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Or who knows, Warners might order up a so-called reboot and do it all again.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.